This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون قوما ولا أذل لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. Congress reconvenes to certify the electoral votes for President-elect Joe Biden after a mob storm suspended the process. At least 4 people die amid chaotic scenes inside the U.S. Capitol after pro-Trump rioters stormed the building in a stunning bid to overturn his election defeat. And 4 former U.S. presidents denounced violence at Capitol Hill during a demonstration against the validation of the Electoral College votes. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the U.S. Congress has resumed the process of certifying Electoral College votes after it went into recess when supporters of President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building. The Senate rejected an objection to the Pennsylvania presidential election. The House of Representatives should next vote on the matter. Earlier, both chambers rejected a move by Trump allies to overturn Joe Biden's victory in Arizona. Only 12 Electoral College votes were counted before the session was interrupted by pro-Trump rioters. The certification process is usually a ceremonial event, but objections by Republicans could delay the process. There are 538 electoral votes. Biden secured 306 votes in the November presidential election, more than the 270 needed to get a majority. Let's bring in Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College in San Francisco. And also Danny Shaw, professor of Latin American and Caribbean studies from New York. Gentlemen, welcome. Mr. Rasmus, if I could first start with you and get your reaction to the quite astonishing scenes that we're seeing taking place or have taken place in Washington and across the U.S. Are you surprised at how polarized America has become?
Oh, no, it's been quite polarized for some time, especially during the last year here. So, with Trump really winding these people up and preparing them for the demonstrations, I mean, he asked them to come to Washington here. He went out and spoke with them this morning, told them to go down to the Capitol. He's really complicit in, instigating the whole thing. I've been writing about this and I've been saying that, I don't think Trump or certainly his friends in Congress, those 12 senators who had started out and 140 representatives, all Republicans, have any illusion that Biden is not going to be certified as the president. He will. There's no way. They know it. They're not stupid. They know it. So why are they doing this anyway? Is it because they're afraid of Trump, not supporting them when they run for office again? Are they just pandering to Trump's base? Well, yeah, that too. But I think there's something longer term to this. And what I've been saying is this is really a fight for the Republican Party. And I think that this whole event here with the demonstration today was designed to build the party, the grassroots and the base, build the party and to intimidate and get more Republican senators and representatives to come over to Trump's side, even though they couldn't get a majority to stop this certification of Biden. And then use today's demonstration, which was supposed to be more passive, to use it to really build up a demonstration on the 20th. I predicted Trump would not leave the White House on the 20th. That might be different now. And that he would have his demonstrators surround the White House and defend him. He wants as much chaos as he can. And that supports his claim that, he never lost the election. And that brings him into the post-January period here where he continues building this movement and maintains control of the Republican Party. You see, he has to maintain control of that party because he knows the traditional Republicans will challenge him after the election. And he knows he needs that in order to build his support and to run again. So I think this was all about party building and grabbing control of the Republican Party, but it backfired on him today, you see? It really backfired, and the demonstration got out of control, and now he's in deep trouble because he's united the political class and the legislatures around him, around themselves, to go after him now. Now he's really in trouble, and there's serious talk about invoking the 25th Amendment. Even people in his cabinet are talking about that now, and even some GOP senators are talking about that now. In other words, they're not going to let this demonstration on the 20th occur. They may either move him out before then, but if they don't, Washington, D.C. will be a military camp on January 20th, and there will be now no great demonstration, as he had thought he could arrange.
Right. Danny, regarding the incident itself, the siege and the storming of the U.S. Congress, do you see that as among perhaps the worst security breaches in American history?
Professor Erasmus said... this was highly predictable today. There has to be some level of communication or collusion between the state in D.C., the D.C. police. There's no way they could be that naive as these fascist forces, white supremacist forces, these casts of characters, some dressed as Vikings, others waving the Israeli flag, others waving the Iranian flag from the era of the Shah, and other strange flags that appear today. There's no way that D.C. security, the mayor of D.C., called for help from the National Guard, but her pleas were ignored. Just yesterday, 10 former secretaries of defense signed a letter saying how important it was to unite against Trump and his base. So this was something that was in motion for weeks, and if not months at this point. And so why did the D.C. police and the National Guard, why were they so slow? And there's actually footage of them opening up the gates to this fascist mob. And of course, the entire movement here is wondering if this had been Black Lives Matter, if this had been immigrant and Latino and African-American protesters, how much blood would have been shed today. So American hypocrisy, as the CIA, former CIA director, has correctly pointed out, all of the world is watching, from Moscow to Beijing to Tehran to Caracas to Havana, and American hypocrisy, not democracy, is on full display.
That's a very interesting point you raised there. Danny, Jack, would you agree with that? If those were Black Lives Matter protesters, would we have seen a different scenario today?
Well, there's over 1,000 Capitol police guarding the U.S. Capitol. Where were they? For hours and hours. And as Danny said, in some cases, they just let these people in. They certainly didn't try to stop them. And there are all kind of videos of, you know, these Capitol Police in the quarters, you know, fraternizing with these people and taking selfies, as they say, with them, you know, and just shaking hands and everything. If this was Black Lives Matter or Antifa, they never would have been allowed in. And there would have been a lot more violence, no doubt here. So there is a question, you know, why did 1,000 Capitol Police just do nothing? And why didn't D.C. police come around for at least 6 hours? You know, there were hours before they even got any help from anybody. So it was all very, very curious affair, you know. And I heard that Nancy Pelosi had talked with the chief of the Capitol Police, and he assured them, assured her that no one would even get on the steps of the Capitol if they came. Because, you know, we knew this was going to happen. We knew there were going to be demonstrations there. But, you know, I think the Capitol Police let it get out of hand. And someone needs to answer for that. And it wouldn't have happened to the extent it did. But, right. You know, it backfired, as I said. It backfired on them. And now they're in even deeper trouble than they were in the very beginning here. And it's going to be interesting to see what Trump does in the next 72 hours, because he's really under attack now from the rest of the political elite that have closed ranks against him. And he may not make it to January 20th.
Well, the man who could is Joe Biden. Danny, he gave quite a rather somber televised address while Capitol Hill was being stormed. What did you make of that? Was that of the president-elect? Was that presidential material? Was that commander-in-chief material?
Oh, my goodness, absolutely not. It was a very meek, weak address. Biden went very soft on this mob. And we saw the absolute restraint with which the state acted. It appears that the police did open fire and did kill the one woman who was trying to scale into another corridor. She was a former veteran of the Air Force. This is certainly an embarrassment for the United States. The whole world is watching. As Jack said, Trump is more isolated than ever. Pence is now disowning Trump, and Trump is on the Twitter attack against Pence. A large group of manufacturers and CEOs, key business interests of this country, have banded together against Trump. Trump is right now banned from Twitter. And his Twitter has been censored now for months. But nonetheless, Trump has the 73 million Americans who voted for him. He has a strong fascist, a violent, armed base. So in the next 2 weeks, we could continue to see these types of incidents. And what's perhaps even more worrying is lone wolf incidents, racist, xenophobic attacks against Muslims and immigrants and Latinos. As we've been seeing, a spike in hate crimes since Trump first assumed office, white supremacy and the Confederacy were in the closet, and Trump brought that all out into the open as of 4 years ago.
Right, and Jack, we've heard from four former U.S. presidents all denouncing the violence and the scenes, some of them shocking. You know, you got President Bush describing it as a banana republic, America. Having said that, will we see a strong international condemnation or perhaps any other punitive measures against the U.S. as is the norm? The U.S. leads these kinds of calls if these incidents, should they occur in other countries?
Well, I don't think you're going to find any condemnation of what's going on in the U.S. by other countries. They're going to play it very carefully here and not try to inject themselves, because that would just play into the hands of Trump or even Biden, you know. So I think they'll keep their hands off. And by the way, with regard to that, I thought it was a rising possibility that Trump would try to provoke something with Iran. Or to manufacture a provocation with Iran in these final 2 weeks. I don't think that's on the agenda now. You know, the 10 former secretaries of defense all came out last week against Trump trying to overturn the election. But I think that was really a signal of unity and a message to the U.S. armed forces, not to follow Trump if he tries a provocation here.
Right.
You know, remaining weeks. I think that was very real, you know, because before they came out, I think it was Esper, who was the Secretary of Defense, who had ordered, who had ordered the U.S. aircraft carrier Nimitz to leave the Persian Gulf. Yeah. But as soon as he was gone, that was ordered to return to the Persian Gulf. And other things were activated. I think Trump was planning something. But, you know, now I don't think he dares.
Right.
I don't think he dares to try that provocation right now. I don't think other countries are going to interfere with what's going on in the U.S. They're going to watch it closely, though.
Okay, Jack, thank you very much indeed for that. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. We have run out of time. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Jack Rasmus, Professor of Political Economy at St. Mary's College from San Francisco. And Daniel Shaw, Professor of Latin American and Caribbean Studies from New York. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Now, four former U.S. presidents have denounced the rioting by Donald Trump supporters on Capitol, the Capitol building. In a statement, former President Barack Obama described the attack as a moment of great dishonor and shame for America. Obama accused Trump of lying about the outcome of a lawful election. Former Republican President George W. Bush also drew a comparison between the incident and how election results are disputed in, quote, a banana republic. President-elect Joe Biden also denounced the storming, calling for an end to the chaos.
This is not dissent. It's disorder. It's chaos. It borders on sedition. And it must end now.
Biden also described the storming as an assault on U.S. democracy. 42nd President Bill Clinton condemned what he called an unprecedented assault, blaming Trump for fueling the riots. Jimmy Carter, the 39th American president, slammed the raid as a national tragedy. He called for a peaceful resolution that can help complete the transfer of power. Several lawmakers from both parties have also denounced the current president for what they called inciting a coup. Top officials, meanwhile, from around the world have also condemned the storming of the U.S. Congress building by pro-Trump supporters. Let's take a listen to that.
In the eyes of the world, American democracy tonight appears under siege. This is an unseen assault on the U.S. democracy, its institutions, and the rule of law. This is not America. The election results of the 3rd of November must be fully respected.
Disgraceful scenes in U.S. Congress. The United States stands for democracy around the world, and it is now vital that there should be a peaceful and orderly transfer of power.
The violent acts against American institutions are a grave attack against democracy. I condemn them. The American people's will and vote must be respected.
Political commentator Kyla Popeshez says most U.S. Republicans do not support what Donald Trump and his followers are doing.
Actually, I do think that the Republicans, majority of them still side with the ruling. They are part of the ruling class. And the ruling class is not going to concede their power. The Republicans, the Democrats, they are united in one issue that is maintaining capitalism. It's maintaining this liberal, democratic, capitalist country. Whereas those who are storming the Capitol right now, those who are calling for recounting the votes, calling this the steal the vote campaign, those are on the far right that would rather overthrow the government and establish their own fascistic far right government that is not in line with the interests of the ruling class that we have now. So I do believe that despite the fact that the Democrats are going to have a majority, they're not that far off from the Republicans, and what they are interested in, what they are both interested in, is maintaining a liberal capitalist hegemony, both in the United States and in the globe. But the far right and Donald Trump and that camp of Republicans, which most Republicans are denouncing, most Republicans are not in support of what him and his supporters are doing right now. So I think that the Senate will actually be more united, but those in the country, the people of this country, will be reaping the consequences between what is happening now and today.
Residents of the Syrian capital's countryside have come together to commemorate the first martyrdom anniversary of Iranian top commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq last year. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has more in this report.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country. A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
When detainees at an Alabama jail got sick or simply asked to be tested, they were put in solitary confinement, says Clarissa Donnelly D. Roven, writer, in an article published under the heading, Immigrants Detained by ICE Say They Were Punished for Requesting COVID-19 Tests. Here's the details of this article. ETOA, which contracts with the federal government to hold people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, stated in court documents that it was taking precautions recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, including quarantining new arrivals, implementing social distancing measures, and providing cleaning supplies. But Golding and more than a dozen other ICE detainees say the measures taken were inadequate and led to a massive COVID-19 outbreak. Seven of the men say they were given only one disposable mask every 3 weeks. One shared a photo of what he said were the only cleaning supplies he'd received. A toothbrush, toothpaste, comb, and combination shampoo body wash, which came inside a gift bag from the Salvation Army emblazoned with the words Merry Christmas. Immigrants inside ETOA also said that many new arrivals were quarantined for 5 or 8 days rather than the recommended 2-week period, potentially allowing the virus to spread. According to a partial ETOA roster obtained by The Intercept, and in these times, ICE transferred at least 24 people into the facility in June. By the second half of July, the agency reported that 21 detainees, nearly a quarter of those housed in ETOWA's ICE unit, were sick. When Golding came out of his cell and saw the condition of those around him, the organizer part of his brain clicked back. I'm looking at people that's literally looking play in the face, he said. And medical is doing nothing for them. Golding decided to tell everyone in the unit to request a test for COVID-19. So you have Africans, you have Jamaicans, you have El Salvadorans, you have different groups, Golding explained. What I did was say, hey, listen, you talk to your people, you tell them this. Many people were apprehensive about asking for a test, as guards had already put the few who were presumed positive into solitary confinement, a fate the United Nations says amounts to torture. In solitary, detainees said they were locked in cells without air conditioning for around 23 hours a day. The average high temperature in July in Gadsden is 91 degrees. Nevertheless, by July 4th, everyone in the unit, more than 80 people, had put in requests to be tested, according to interviews with Golink and another detainee, as well as the affidavits of 9 detainees included in a petition for a writ of habeas. Golink filed on his own behalf in the Northern District of Alabama in September. 2 days later, according to the 11 detainees, Etowah County Sheriff's Officer Captain Mike O'Brien called the lockdown of the unit and read out the names of 10 detainees who'd been especially vocal in calling for mass testing, including Golding. O'Brien told them to pack their bags because they were being sent to solitary confinement. At the time of their transfer, none had tested positive for COVID-19. All 11 sources said they felt this was punishment and retaliation for requesting the coronavirus test. I noted that all of us who were randomly picked were the ones who were vocal, outspoken, and shown desire to be tested, Stanley Walden wrote in a complaint dated on August 7th. He handpicked cells and made an example in front of everyone that he really meant to throw anyone who get tested into a dungeon, Sebastian Abalo Kana wrote in a complaint dated on July 28. It feels like punishment for standing up for our right to health and safety, he said. After locking down the unit, the captain and other staff members went cell to cell asking the remaining detainees if they still wanted to be tested for COVID-19, according to Golding and the affidavits of 9 others. Most detainees revoked their request and agreed to sign waivers saying they no longer wanted to be tested. In a recorded conversation involving 2 Etowah employees obtained by The Intercept and in These Times, one employee described the events of the July 6th as an attempt to bully people into not getting tested. Afterwards, both employees said in the recording, immigrants inside Etowah appear too scared to seek even basic medical care. 4 of those who were sent to solitary confinement said they were unable to communicate with their families for days, leading some concerned family members to call the facility. The relatives of one detainee said jail staff assured them that their family member was fine at the time he was in solitary confinement, having developed symptoms of COVID-19. Golding's mother said she was told there was no evidence of the virus at the facility, even as ICE listed at least 1 coronavirus case at Etowah on its website. According to the family members interviewed for this story, neither ICE nor Etowah ever reached out to tell them their loved ones were sick. The Etowah County Sheriff's Office did not respond to detailed questions from The Intercept and in These Times about the jail's COVID-19 precautions, the detainees' allegations of retaliation, and whether detainees had authorized the release of their medical information to family members. The health, safety, and welfare of those in our care remain a top priority and concern for the agency, a spokesperson for ICE wrote in an emailed statement. Since the outbreak of COVID-19, ICE has taken extensive steps to safeguard all detainees, staff, and contractors, including reducing the number of detainees in custody by placing individuals on alternatives to detention programs, suspending social visitation, incorporating social distancing practices with staggered meals and recreation times, and through the use of cohorting and medical isolation. ICE's public guidance on how detention centers should respond to the pandemic says facilities must ensure that medical isolation is operationally distinct from administrative or disciplinary segregation or any punitive form of housing. Yet, as a previous investigation by The Intercept found, A number of ICE facilities have failed to adhere to this requirement. According to detainees at Etowah, solitary confinement was used not only as leverage to discourage requests for testing, but also to isolate people with COVID-19. The Intercept and In These Times spoke with five men who tested positive for COVID-19 while detained at Etowah. Each said he spent weeks in solitary confinement. Shamoe Edwards developed COVID-19 symptoms just days before going. At first, he planned to quietly sweat out the illness, but with a history of bronchitis and a recent diagnosis of sickle cell trait, he got too scared to ride it out on his own. He hobbled over to an officer and told him he felt like he'd been hit by a truck. Not long afterwards, Edwards said he was transferred to solitary confinement. The men universally described the conditions in solitary confinement as squalid. In their affidavits, many expressed distress that they no longer had access to mental health professionals, the law library, sunlight, or fresh air. Civil detention have turned into torture, Fele Koroma said. Bakadir Majidov, who was deported in September, wrote that there were cockroaches and flies in the unit. Golding wrote that he was fed uncooked, frozen food and didn't have access to drinking water because the sink in his cell didn't flow properly. One detainee said he spent 21 days in isolation. Another counted 35 days and a third counted 54. Golding said he was in solitary confinement from July 6 until August 28. Edward said he was put in isolation on June 29 and wasn't released until July 28. "We were getting the same treatments as when you get in trouble," Edward said in an interview. "Even though it's properly a different word, it's isolation. It's still a form of punishment, a form of torture that they are putting us in." Edwards received the results from his coronavirus test on July 8. He was positive. One day later, Golding received the same bad news. In isolation, the men say their phone access was limited. They could only make calls during a brief daily free period, no more than 75 minutes, which occurred on an irregular schedule. Sometimes they said it might be in the middle of the night. Before he got sick, Edwards would speak with his mother and brother a few times each week. After not hearing from him during the 5 week of July, his brother, Nico Edwards, who is a police officer in Flint, Michigan, called Etowah. The first person he spoke to transferred him to someone else. "That person answered and told me that they looked in the computer and they told me Shamoy is okay. He's on the floor and nothing is wrong with him." Nikoy believed the facility at first, then a few weeks later, his brother finally called, telling Nikoy he was in solitary confinement and had the coronavirus. The U.S. criminal justice system and the immigration system are deeply entangled, with harsh consequences for black immigrants in particular. One out of every five people facing deportation because of a criminal conviction is black. As of July, about half of the people detained by ICE at Etowah were black, including Golding, Edwards, and many of the other men interviewed for this story. Several are lawful permanent residents who lost their green cards and became deportable after criminal convictions. Rather than accept deportation, many immigrants remain at Etowah for years as they fight their cases, often because they have nothing to go back to. Golding and Edwards were both born in Jamaica and came to the United States of America as children. Edwards, now 30, arrived at 15 on a green card, Most of his family now lives in the United States. Golding, now 36, arrived at age 9 to reunite with his mother, who had fled an abusive relationship. He has never been back to Jamaica. Before being incarcerated by ICE, Golding served a 10-year sentence in federal prison. He and his family say they didn't know there would be immigration consequences for his criminal conviction and that he was served his time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Primarily liberation. Perhaps following the collapse of the most populated city of Iraq after Baghdad, that is Mosul, Daesh militants reckoned they would go to Amirli for picnics and hunting trips during the weekends to add Turkmen people there to their collection of Arabs and Kurds killed and captivated by them. However, they were not aware that their Amirli picnic area would become the one battleground determining their fate. Usually, the popularity of a public figure in any country is limited to its borders. In spite of this, there are some artists whose huge fame has exceeded their country's borders. Politicians, however, oftentimes do not enjoy such fame. Military men have even a lesser chance in this regard. However, remember this, that the two countries of Iran and Iraq less than 30 years earlier had been engaged in the world's last classic war, which lasted longer than World War II. What changed the equations that now senior Iranian commanders had become the most popular Iranian figures among the Iraqi people? Amirli is a township in Saladin province located less than 100 kilometers from the Iranian borders. It is comprised of Sunni and Shia Muslims, Kurds and Turkmens. Some say the local inhabitants are descendants of Turkish migrants who moved here from Anatolia. Others say the inhabitants are of Iranian and Azerbaijani origin. Despite speculation in this regard, Amirli today has become a source of pride for the historical lands which host cities including Babylon, Baghdad, and Ctesiphon or Mada'in. Is the prosperity of a land limited to the amount of rain it gets and the degree of its fertility? Here in this desert land, you see prosperity shouting out loud. Do you not see souls blossoming here? Do you not see God's blessing blowing across these desert lands? Little girls will become teachers and nurses one day,
They might become homekeepers. They will surely be mothers and tell their children stories about the conflict. They will relate memories of the difficult times. However, in between these stories, I'm sure they will mention the names of their heroes as well. Amerli is under siege. It is surrounded inside a 360-degree circle. In other words, any person in town can take a rifle in hand and become one of the thousands of fighters guarding the town with eyes wide open day and night to stop the enemy from attacking and infiltrating from any point through the lines using their suicide bombers. Being under siege means one not being able to even wish for getting the slightest amount of rest in Amerli. Being under siege means that even if all the fighters die defending the town, the girls will have at least one grenade tucked into the corner of their shawls. Thousands of novels, films, and pictures have been made about the occupation of Paris by the German Nazis and the bombardment of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. However, very little has been made by them about the bombardment of Dresden in Germany by the British, and the same story goes for the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They have no mercy on themselves. They will not help us. They will neither mourn our dead ones nor observe 1 minute silence in honor of those of us who were killed in the genocide. Why should we wait until the genocide of thousands of people in Amerli becomes the headline of a local newspaper? We have decided to take our destiny into our own hands, to have history record our fate in a different way. It was not the first time that a helicopter was headed to Amerli to transfer an old person in critical condition or a pregnant woman about to give birth to the nearest safe place. When a siege lasts more than a month, there is no guarantee that it would not last for a year. When the siege becomes lengthy, the people who are more important than the leading male figures and the brave fighters are the mothers who accompany them. These mothers will prepare a piece of bread to send their fully fed men to the war front, and they will put their children to bed by promising to give them treats later on. These women are the ones who sing the children's lullabies loudly so their men do not get distressed by hearing them cry for lack of medicine. In late spring 2014, Daesh was celebrating its honeymoon. The oil they had seized from Syria's Deir ez-Zor had fueled their move to northern Iraq, where they also gained access to huge water supplies. Prior to the collapse of Mosul, they were more similar to a militia force. However, now by taking Mosul, they had gained access to enough military hardware to turn them into a classic army. Taking $500 million from the central bank in Mosul brought Daesh closer to establishing its self-proclaimed caliphate of Iraq and Levant. Despite Daesh forces' insistence for symbolically using traditional weapons and doing decapitations, the link between Daesh and modernism is an odd story. The Daesh forces were mobilized from across the globe, particularly Europe and Northern Africa, using Twitter and Facebook to recruit militants. YouTube published Daesh video trailers showing killings and plundering, letting the militant group to sow the seeds of terror and fear. The domino-like fall of the cities of Mosul, Tikrit, and Fallujah, alongside the unwarranted massacre of 1,500 Iraqi servicemen at Spiker Air Base, would demoralize fighters who had been defending the cities. The The bigger the city, the less resistance they would show against Daesh. However, the small towns turned into difficult targets for Daesh to take. The smaller the town, the more resistance it showed against the enemy. Al-Fo'a and Kafaria, as well as Nubla and Azara, and now Amerli. News was slowly spreading that help was on its way. 16 days has passed since Amerli had been encircled by the enemy. Telling anybody that help was on its way was regarded as an untimely joke. When they talked about help coming, they would look into the skies. The strongest believers among them could not imagine for a second that even God's own angels would be willing to set foot in this hellhole. However, when dozens of youths spent 2 hours in the southeast of the town clearing the ground of rocks for a makeshift helicopter pad, there was no noise sweeter than that of a helicopter arriving in Amerli. Perhaps there were some armed men around here to know that the passengers of this aircraft were far from regular. Say, a Daesh sniper wanted to target one or two of them. Which ones would he shoot? Neither one of them had any military insignia on their uniforms, not an olive wreath nor a black or gold eagle to distinguish them and show their rank. Just a group of determined senior and younger men whose skin had been tanned under the sun. Even the sad and suffering people of Amerli had no idea which passenger was to be given the most attention and respect of all. When we review the list of the martyrs of Haram, not even one of them had been killed in Amerli. This proves that all that they needed was to have their spirits uplifted. The presence of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis did this and lifted their spirits. We did not have the feeling that a stranger from another country was among us. In fact, we counted him as one of our own. Some of the inhabitants of the town were hopeful that help would come from outside town. Some were even hopeful that international organizations would send help. They followed the news on international channels. Neither in the headlines nor in the body of the articles there was any mention of Amerli. News coverage about the extinction of tigers in 2014 was more important than the genocide of the people of Amerli. If there were some who were still doubtful about defending the town, after they saw the refugees of Tal Afar fleeing from their homes with eyes filled with fear, their doubts were gone. They had now become ready soldiers, counting the minutes to get the order from their commander to engage the enemy. When the helicopter was ready to fly, it should have taken the shortest path to reduce the risk of being hit by missiles. However, General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis insisted that the helicopter should pass above the enemy positions so they could see how many they were and what equipment they had. So now that he was monitoring the enemy front line from the ground, he could give precise coordinates to the artillery guns to strike the enemy positions. One must justify the Amerli host's concerns when he crossed over the front line wearing his everyday civilian clothing. As usual, you're not wearing a bulletproof vest. The only protection you have is the holy strip of cloth strapped to your arm, alongside the blessings of millions of women and children in the region that guards you against harm. I doubt that any fighter in any combat could match you in bravery. However, we have grievances about Iraq related to the events that took place in the month of Muharram of the year 61 of the Arabic lunar calendar and to the month of Day of the year 1398 of the Iranian solar calendar. It is naive to think that the commander was simply looking at the enemy front line to monitor it. By looking at the front line, he was figuring out the enemy's underlying strategy. He was not looking at what was currently just threatening Iraq and Syria. He was figuring out the dangers that were threatening others thousands of kilometers away. Your turn will come. Now, either with him in presence or with his memories, it will take place. Militias usually fight against the central government. However, perhaps the most effective method that General Soleimani used to gain victory was to persuade these forces to fight alongside the central government against the threat posed by the terrorists. His method transformed the Islamic Republic from a country that was engaged in defending itself against Ba'athist attacks imposed on its soil decades ago into a force which, in this decade, has its senior military commander driven in his vehicle nonstop all the way from Tehran to Lebanon and occupied Palestine. The value of a gift, whether small or big, will be determined in time. The Arabic scarf of General Soleimani, which is in the hands of this teenager 1 year after the commander's martyrdom, has undoubtedly turned into the flag and symbol of the town. A flag that reminds one of the martyrs. This scarf is the flag of 8 years of Iraq's history. This scarf has the scent of all the Iraqi and Iranian martyrs whose blood blended with one another. The terrorists had blocked the entrance to Amerli of food and non-food consignments by land. The rivers leading to the town had been blocked as well. That is why the women in this town, who have a custom of throwing rice on the heads of the fighters who had defended them, have nothing to throw on the heads of the victors today to celebrate the town's liberation. However, there was nothing to worry about because the days of the abundance were near. Abu Mahdi had been to Amerli before. General Soleimani had witnessed several other areas that had been under siege as well. However, when the two of them came together, it was a game changer that altered all equations. Everyone knew that this combination meant support and courage. After Amerli was turned for Tikrit and then Mosul, and later on, Aleppo and Bukima, and probably in the future, it will be the occupied lands. A winning combination must not be changed. They were together. Even at the earthquake in Sarapul-e-Zahab, they were together. Even during the floods in Khuzestan, they were together once more in January 2020. They are still together, with arms on each other's shoulders. They're watching over us to make sure we stay together. The small town of Amerli taught us amazingly big lessons.
In the limelight.
That a British court has ruled that the US prison system is too barbaric to guarantee the safety of Assange tells its own story. But this is about something much bigger than Assange. It's about journalism, the free press, and the ability to expose atrocities committed by the world's last remaining superpower. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, "Threat to Journalism Remains," warns critics after Assange extradition rejected solely due to brutal U.S. prison system. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Why did a British judge reject the Trump administration's attempt to extradite Julian Assange despite accepting virtually all of the allegations the U.S. government leveled against the WikiLeaks founder? The answer lies not in the dire threat extradition would pose to press freedoms across the globe, but in the dangerous abomination that is the U.S. prison system. In her 132-page ruling issued on Monday, January 4th, Judge Vanessa Barrister of the Westminster Court on Monday described the conditions Assange would face in the U.S. as harsh, even compared to London's notorious maximum security Belmarsh Jail, where the publisher has been held since April of 2019. After dismissing arguments against extradition brought by Assange's legal team, including their warnings that the WikiLeaks founder would be denied a fair trial in the U.S., Barrister said she believes that if confined to a U.S. supermax prison, Mr. Assange's mental health would deteriorate, causing him to commit suicide. Faced with conditions of near total isolation without the protective factors, which limited his risk at Her Majesty prison.